Hi, Redbeard here from InTheStudio.net with my guest, Jackson Browne, on the 35th anniversary of his February 1986 album, Lives in the Balance. Ever since the No Nukes concert in 1979, Jackson Browne had grown increasingly active in a variety of high-profile humanitarian causes, including nuclear energy, climate change, famine, and apartheid in South Africa, which imprisoned Nelson Mandela and denied rights to the majority living there. But not until Lives in the Balance had the popular singer-songwriter turned his introspective mirror around to be a parabolic one in his songs, casting a critical eye on the horizon and reporting back from the front lines. Not every music critic was willing to make the excursion, however. While Rolling Stone magazine reviewer Jimmy Guterman had the courage to assess Lives in the Balance on its own merits, noting Browne's, and I quote, newfound ability to link the personal to the political, Browne is not just writing about headlines, he's trying to tell the stories of the people they affect, end quote. But critique Brahmin's William Roman said, its approach inevitably limited its appeal and its long-term significance, end quote. And Robert Christgau, who wrote, quote, Browne shouldn't be doing this. He's a pop star who's stretching his audience and endangering his market share, end quote. Clearly, those two couldn't care less about Jackson's woke awareness of the Reagan years. I started my conversation with that devil's advocate point of view. To some, entertainers and sports stars should just act or sing and dance and score touchdowns for our amusement, but keep their political opinions to themselves. Here's Jackson Browne in the studio.
I don't know. I don't know what you call Ronald Reagan and Nancy Reagan. I mean, I think it'd be hard to be aware of some of the things that are going on and not being angry. I don't think I'm the only one who's angry, but I think we're encouraged these days. You know, I mean, in our society, we're encouraged not to really pay attention. I mean, as a matter of fact, the people who are getting away with subverting the Constitution, people who are getting away with killing the rainforest or killing dolphins or you know, defiling the planet, people who are getting away with things that endanger the planet, count on us not knowing anything about it. You know, you have to ask, like a covert war, I mean, who is this war a secret from? It's not a secret from the people who are being killed. And it's not a secret from our enemies. It's a secret from the American people who fund it. And I don't mind anybody saying that I'm angry. There are a number of things I really am angry about. Of course, you know, if you have a chance to talk about these things, you know, it's a privilege, and I hope that I don't abuse it by just ranting and raving and talking about things that people have no access to. You know, it's not my intention to sort of supplant other people's anger. You know what I mean? I don't think it's right to sort of sit. I don't feel it's right to just display one's own anger. I mean, if I could possibly make some other people angry, too, I think it'd be worthwhile. I feel that we're, you know, well, speaking for myself, I'm in a position. You know, I get to make a lot of money and do what I love to do for a living, and it's out of a sense of gratitude that you try to put some back or do things that are, you know, you generally, once you've taken care of your own needs, have the ability to think of others, and I don't know anybody that doesn't feel that way. I mean, other players, you know, I mean, who just about everybody I've ever talked to, you know, jumps at the opportunity to do something in a way of benefits, you know, when they're asked. You know, then there are a few troublemakers who were always, you know, always doing stuff. Bonnie Raitt, Graham Nash, and now I think more and more. One of the reasons we have so many benefits is because government is doing so little for people. You know, there are all these ways that government benefits big business and tries to help the economy and trickle down and all that. But you know, it really says a lot when you have to have a benefit to take care of veterans. We have to have a benefit to raise money to research a disease like AIDS. You know, it's really, it tells you a lot about where our priorities are.
Great song featuring the plaintive sax of Phil Kenzie and great guitar of Dallas native Gary Myrick on For America by Jackson Browne from the album Lives in the Balance.
I think it's important to understand what's changing try to understand how the world is changing and what the forces are at play. If you can, I don't mean that I do. I mean it'd be good to try to understand that, and I try to understand it, but I I also wanted to say that there are, you know, I mean, it's not like the world is only recently endangered. I mean, there are people who, you know, who for the last, let's say, a group like Oxfam America that have been trying to help ease world hunger for 40 years. I mean, it's not a recent development. There are all sorts of organizations. CARE is another one that has been working for many, many years in the area of hunger. And then there are people like, you know, Jacques Cousteau and just countless people who are, I think of them as the angels, you know, people who a long time ago decided to do something positive and to try to help matters. And I think it's really, because there are so many things that threaten us, it's really important to focus on those things that are making a difference, those people, those organizations, those projects that are making a difference. And to, because if you don't, you just become overwhelmed. You just become overwhelmed by all the negative things happening. It's really important to see what there is that can be done. Well, they're selling us this image of ourselves, and they're selling us a picture of life as we would like it to be. I mean, they're very, very good at selling us stuff. I mean, that's really what our economy is. I think the danger is that we begin to look at, you know, we stop looking at the world as it is and sort of exist in these TV references of what the world is like. No, I mean, like, look at videos. I mean, they're very instructive, really. You know, I mean, they perpetuate a lot of sexism and a lot of violence and a lot of really silly, you know, impressions of ourselves. Some of them, some of them are really very good, too. I mean, if you ask me what the danger is not living in the world. It's living in a little TV screen that's where people's main motive is to sell you something. I mean, videos, they're trying to sell you an album or an artist. TV commercials, they want you to buy Kodak film or make a long distance phone call to your grandmother, or they want you to, you know, buy a car because this is a girl there telling you that, you know, if you buy the, you know, if you buy this kind of car, you know, she's going to get in it with you. And, you know, I mean, it's just, I mean, okay, so that's what our economy is based on, is selling stuff to each other. But there are all kinds of people that can't afford to buy anything because they don't have the basics. And unfortunately, there are like more and more and more children growing up without the means to escape this kind of dead-end life. I mean, it's not just a few now. I mean, there's a really alarming percentage of the population living below the poverty line, more and more. We're losing our civilization, our humanity. We're losing our ability to move forward because we're creating this vast population of people who have no other recourse but to sort of feed on each other. Violently, they're completely shut out. What they are, they don't have, you know. I mean, you wonder why there's so many kids. I mean, they're not. I could, you know, go on about this particular one, but I mean, so many weapons and drugs in our inner cities. You know, a kid can make $1,000 really in a very short time holding a weapon and selling drugs. You know, whereas he might have to work for months to save that kind of money. You know, doing the kind of jobs that are available to him, if he can find one, and there aren't that many. I mean, and what's more is that there's a ceiling to his, you know, there's a problem with, you know, what kind of job he can get even if he does succeed in getting himself an education. These are the kind of things you look at, you know, you point to government to solve, you know. Why are we funding the arms race? Well, you know, there are a lot of people who make a lot of money making those weapons, and we can't even use them. But the same industry that makes the conventional weapons that makes the nuclear weapons that we can't use also makes a lot of conventional weapons which we do use and which also get sold in the black market. I mean, I like my song, the word justice. I try to draw a connection between the drugs and the guns in our city streets and neighborhoods and the wars that we have found ourselves in the last, you know, the covert wars, the ones in the last 25, 30, 40 years. I mean, that's where all these things sort of meet. If you wonder where the drugs come from, look where the wars are fought, you know, Southeast Asia, South America and Central America, and the Middle East, areas like Afghanistan.
God is great, God is back. Something happens.
Soldier of Plenty from Jackson Browne's February 1986 album Lives in the Balance. The involvement of the Reagan administration in selling illegal drugs and guns out of the basement of the White House by Oliver North and John Poindexter, even while First Lady Nancy Reagan championed the Just Say No anti-drug campaign, seems too far-fetched to believe as Lives in the Balance was being released. Of course, since then, multiple movies have been released with the subplot, including Air America with Mel Gibson and Robert Downey Jr., Whiskey Tango Foxtrot with Tina Fey and Billy Bob Thornton, and American Made with Tom Cruise.
Yeah, but also it's a tremendously high, you know, financial yield there, but also it's not the sort of thing that can be regulated very easily. You know, I mean, you can't, I mean, it's completely illicit, but I mean, how does it get in and out of the country? I mean, we actually support all kinds of secret activities. What I'm trying to say is that, you know, like, where you have secret dealings with arms dealers, and you've got flights of weapons being sent to rebels in Afghanistan, you also have empty planes coming back. And there, I mean, if anybody doubts this at this late stage, they should really just, I mean, it's even in Penthouse magazine, you can read all about how our government basically turned a blind eye to to drug dealing on the part, and we actually hired drug dealers to help us conduct our secret war against Nicaragua, and we hired them because they were the experts at smuggling and flying things in secretly. We even let them fill their planes with drugs on the way back, and turned a blind eye to their drug smuggling in exchange for them smuggling weapons to our proxy army in Nicaragua. And so there's a real connection between what we think we can get away with in terms of visiting violence on other people and the violence that is being visited on ourselves as a society. Now, I know you say, it can't be. They can't be. No, they can't be. But, But I think even people who, like me, who sort of suspected that there was lots of underhanded stuff going on and ways in which we were sort of being misled and not told the truth, wound up just being absolutely shocked at the revelations that came out a couple years later. And I found it shocking to find out to the degree to which Congress had been lied to, the degree to which newspapers such, like where false stories had been, planted. I mean, we have a polite word for it. We call it disinformation. But I mean, what it is, pure and simply, is the deception of the American people. I mean, lying. But it's not the first time it's happened. I mean, we've had presidents get up on national TV and lie. Lyndon Johnson lied. He lied to Congress. He lied to the American people about the Gulf of Tonkin incident. And he basically, in so doing, opened the door for our first undeclared war, the first war we fought, where we lost a lot of people and a lot of moral ground and a lot of esteem in the world. It was a war that it was not declared in the way that is prescribed by the Constitution, and did this by claiming we had been attacked, and it was completely fictitious. Somewhere along the line, our leadership began opting for certain what must have seemed to them to be easy solutions. We say that we're in favor of democracy in these countries in Central America and Latin America, yet we seem to favor giving aid to military dictatorships because I think we tend to think that it's more of a sure thing if we're given a free hand militarily, like if we're given the right to have bases, say in Panama or in Guatemala or Honduras, that we will somehow ensure that our interests will be served. And if we didn't do that, and say we gave our support to dialogue and diplomacy between the arguing factions, they might not decide to do something that was in our interest. There are State Department documents, papers that were recently declassified, having to do with the deciding of our policy, in which they flat out say, what we're interested in doing is preserving the disparity between the rich and the poor. We're interested in supporting those factions which will be responsive to our needs and not the needs of their own people. No, it's just policy. It's just simple, geopolitical chess, and it does not jive with our own. We don't adhere to our own values, and we are interdependent. The people of the world are interdependent. The countries of the world, the economies and the cultures are interdependent. You can no longer, I don't know how anybody thinks that they can preserve the kind of disparity. Like this State Department document said, we have 6% of the world's population and 50% of the world's resources, or 30% or something, and it's only a matter of time before these people decide that they want their equal share, and we have to somehow preserve this disparity as much as we can, and we have to dispense with such idealistic things as giving democracy to the rest of the world, because it's not going to work. We'll lose everything. By everything, I think they're referring to their geopolitical advantage, the empire, in other words. I mean, but we're going down the same, like Lou Reed says, I mean, we're going down the road of empire. We're going down the road that England went down in the last century.
I've been waiting for something to happen, for a week or a month or a year, with the blood in the ink of the headlines and the sound of the crowd in my ear. You might ask what it takes to remember when you know that you've seen it before, where a government lies to a people and a country is drifting to war. And there's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again: how the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who find they can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone. And there are lives in the balance, there are people under fire, there are children at the camps, and there is blood on the wire. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who fanned the flames of the wars that are fought in places where we can't even say the names. They sell us the president the same way they sell us our clothes and our cars. They sell us everything from youth to religion, the same time they sell us our wars. I wanna know who the men in the shadows are. I wanna hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are, but they're never the ones to fight or to die. And there are lives in the balance, there are people on the fire, there are children at the camps, and there is blood on the wire.
Somebody told me once, because I was sort of disparaging. This guy was an acting teacher and a really, really a good guy, a friend of mine. His name is Jeff Corey. And I was disparaging the middle class, talking about how something was middle class and was not. And he said, listen, it's really the first time in history there's been one. And it's a great thing, you know. It's a really great thing. And I don't know, I'm not a historian, but I mean, it sounded sort of true. I mean, it's only a recent development in terms of the way societies are structured, that there is a middle class. But it seems to be disappearing. There seem to be more and more poor, and quite a bit richer, a smaller and richer ruling class, leisure class. But see, I am concerned about that. I tend to worry about I'm always referring to it as a consumer culture, you know. I wish people weren't so gullible. I wish they weren't so willing to trade ideals for material things. But at the same time, I don't know if there's any way really to measure, you know, people's ideals except by what they're willing to fight for and what they're willing to, you know, to sacrifice for. And the problem is how do you tell? I mean, how do you what gauge do you use? Unfortunately, we tend to entertain ourselves to the degree that no one can get any interest together for the really important things. I mean, if they told you that by living in Los Angeles you're definitely your kids are going to grow up with lung disease, you know, but yet you have to live in LA because that's where your job is, or you feel you have to. I mean, not you can't all move to the country, right? It's very difficult to keep track of these things, and there are all the other things that are more pressing all the time. I find it really. I think I'm straying from your question about the disappearance of the middle class, but I really think that in a way the consumer culture is the sort of middle ground, that middle of the road by which the middle class sort of emerges. I mean, you know, the problem is that if this middle class is sort of declining, it has to do with the way the society, I think, has to do with the incredible greed on the part of the corporations. You know, I mean, greed is a human, you know, it's a human problem. I don't know if it's right to call it greed on the part of a corporation. A corporation has no conscience. It has no brain. It has no. But the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. And that more and more people are sort of slipping into this, you know, below subsistence level. And also you have unions and people, you know, who are. Now I'm going to get in trouble because basically I'm real pro union, but I recently see that like a certain amount of union activity is sort of fruitless, you know. It's sort of convincing people that, because I just had an experience with a musicians union where we had to have like 17, we need 17 people to put my show up, 17 person union call, and we were forced by a union to hire 34 of them, and really it was made our job twice as hard because there are too many people standing around, and they move slower than one person if they were going to do it, and intentionally almost. I mean, you couldn't get anything done. In a way, it sort of subverted the meaning of what the union is supposed to be. Yeah, I think that there's like the union management of unions. I mean, the leadership of unions seems to be like a separate entity from the rank and file, and it seemed to be powerless in a lot of cases to do very much. I don't know. I actually don't know enough to be talking on a radio show about union stuff.
It was a ruby that she wore on a chain around her neck, in the shape of a heart, in the shape of a heart. It was a time I won't forget, for the sorrow and regret, and the shape of a heart, and the shape of a heart. I guess I never knew what she was talking about. I guess I never knew that she was living without. People speak of love, don't know what they're thinking of. Wait around for the one who fits just like a glove. Speak in terms of belief and belonging. Try to fit some name to their longing. From some ancient fight, about the size of a fist, or something thrown that had missed. There were other holes as well in the house where our nights fell. Far too many to repair in the time that we were there. People speak of love, don't thinking of. Reach out to each other through the push and shove. Speak in terms of the life and the learning.
keep the life from coming apart. Never know what breaches and faults are concealed in the shape of a heart. In the shape of a heart. Shape of a heart. It was the ruby that she wore on a stand beside the bed in the hour before dawn. When I knew she was gone, and I held it in my hand for a little while, dropped it into the wall. I let it go and heard it fall.
I remember that Whole Earth catalog. I think I have that one. That was the last one. I met the guy who I met the guy. The first time I got involved in an Ananuclear concert was in '76, and the guy that had organized it was the guy that had written this bill, which didn't win, but we were fighting for it. I can't even remember his name now, but he was the editor of that magazine. Now we've seen a lot of photographs of the Earth. And there is a book out now that I guess is sort of a coffee table book. I mean, it's a photography book. I can't remember the title of it, but it was put out by an association of astronauts, both Russian and American, and some who some from other countries that have been engaged in either the Russians or our space program. And it shows these photographs of the Earth. They're the most beautiful things I've ever seen. My son gave me this book. He, as a matter of fact, while I was trying to write the last, I wrote this song a while back, and then I needed to change the last part of it. And he gave this to me for my birthday, and it was about the best thing that I got. You know, it's wonderful. What they're really saying is that once you've seen the Earth from a distance, that is your home. You feel that. That is your home. That's what you have in at stake. That's what you need to protect. The planet, you know, it's like you see it from a distance, and it's something more tangible than when you're in your country and you think of, you know, someone from the other side of the world, you know, being a threat to you or a danger. You realize that there's a great deal that threatens your home, the planet, the water planet. I mean, it's and so many of them said that in the text of this book, Russians and Americans and Egyptians and Canadians, and I think some from China too. Yeah, that they went up in space and saw the Earth and realized that they were Earthlings. You know, they're from Earth. And I don't know if it's it's hard for me to, but I think it's simplistic to think, as that guy wrote in the Whole Earth Catalog, that, you know, some sort of, they're not showing us these pictures as they want us to accept the boundaries. I have a very good friend who would adhere to that point of view completely. His name's John Trudell, and he's a North American Indian, and he thinks along those lines quite a bit. But his whole life has been, I mean, he's, you know, grown up on a reservation. He was an Indian activist that was attacked by the Bureau of Indian Affairs and by the FBI all his life, and there, he has been the victim of conspiracies. And he would say, yeah, right. I mean, he thinks like that. But I find it difficult. Yeah, maybe, you know, I think idealistically there might be a reason to have boundaries, I mean, to regulate economy and regulate the movement of people in some positive way. It's like you could think of there being armies that did, you know, acts of good. But unfortunately, it's how they're used or the way in which they're misused that's the problem. You know, you could think about boundaries and the regulation of trade and population the way as a somewhat unnatural thing to do, and but maybe clever and useful, like the way we use the water in a canal, like the locks in the Suez Canal or the Panama Canal, you know, to do something tricky and clever, like, you know, get a boat across this land. But it's hard to justify keeping people separate, I think that for the most part, there's a lot of conspiracy to keep us separate because of our nationalities and our age and our cultural differences. I mean, I think that most wars that have happened happened because someone manipulated cultural differences between people. And it's no secret that there are always, some people who profit a great deal by war, like especially like the song "World in Motion." I think I'm just casting my lot with those people who are trying to make a difference and don't pretend to know how to steer anything. I just think that there are lots of ways we're really sort of made to feel powerless all the time. But there are lots of ways in which we aren't, and ways in which we can make a difference. And it's, you know, we have to find them for ourselves and then do these things. But I don't know, honestly, don't know to what degree. I think rock, I think music, this is our culture, okay? And recently I heard Elvis Costello in some interview saying, you know, oh yeah, to the rest of the world, I mean, that has culture, it's just rock and roll. Here in the United States, it has no culture. You call rock your culture. But I mean, it's true. It's our culture. It's pop culture. And in many ways, it's something that started here and is now, you know, rock and roll is almost, it's world culture. The thing is that it's a reflection of people's ideals and what they want, you know. I mean, people in the United States have always felt generous. We've always felt that, and in a way we're sort of addicted to the view of ourselves that we are in some ways, you know, heroes to other people in the world, and we're willing to give what we have to them. And I think it'd be a good idea if we started demanding of our governments that this be the case, and instead of what we do, which is quite the opposite. I'll give you an example. We may give millions of dollars in aid to the Philippines, but then we also require them to engage in agricultural programs to increase production, which require them to spend all that same money on fertilizers that are sold by, you know, some fertilizer company in Minneapolis. And within a couple of years, the hybrid fertilizers and the hybrid seeds and the power fertilizers have sort of decimated the soil and the farmer's traditional way of working, and it's like an addiction. They have to use higher grade fertilizers or more, you know, but basically, who's paying for it? Well, we are, you know, the taxpayers. It was all because we, you know, because our in quite good intention, we said we were going to help the people of the Philippines, you know, improve their economy and improve their agricultural techniques. And so we gave them millions of our tax dollars to do this. But somebody got given all that money to give them some fertilizer, you know? Same thing with the drug industry. You know, Squibb and Lilly in these countries, and these, this is a good slip, countries, these corporations which are international corporations, sell only a percentage of what they do in countries that have laws regarding their distribution, and a lot of the other stuff is sold at in mass quantity countries like Mexico, and then it's bought and smuggled back into the United States illegally. I mean, like, I think that vast amount of their profits come from selling drugs in countries that really have no real use for them. It's just there. I don't know, but I think that I think one of the things that has to happen is there have to be international accords and agreements and governing this kind of thing, economy, commerce. And I think there have to be controls. Of course, that's that's the opposite of what capitalism wants. Capital doesn't want any kind of free market, no controls. But I mean, I think that as a planet, we're going to have to come to some sort of we're going to come to the point where you actually have to control this, or really it's like cannibalism. It's like these corporations feeding on the world's resources and the world's populations.
This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking my guest, Jackson Brown. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions, copyright 2021, all rights reserved. Transcription by Jane Carpenter Brune, theme song by Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, @RedbeardRocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net.